Food Talk with Mike Colomeco is brought to you by Cento at centofinefoods.com, King Arthur Flour at kingarthurflour.com, and Cola Vita at colavita.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey folks, welcome. Mike Colomeco's Food Talk, been off for a couple of weeks. Great to be back. A couple of minutes late today if you're actually tuning in live. Sorry about that. But I think most of you are probably listening on podcasts or Stitcher. Heritage Radio Network is great that way. You can listen to us anytime, anywhere you want on your handheld. That is the new media, isn't it? Happy New Year. I wished you that a couple of weeks ago, I think. I'm late. It's blizzard in New York this past week. Well, sort of a pseudo-blizzard. New York freaks out when it snows, but the subways aren't, still they aren't quite running right. So a couple minutes late, but we're here. Great show lined up today. We're going to have a quick talk with a cause that's pretty near and dear to me, New York City Rescue Mission. Craig Mize, the new executive director. It's New York's oldest rescue mission, New York's oldest mission, been around since the late 1800s with one cause in mind, which is to get people that are down and out on the streets who have lost any chance of luck, don't have any support, to get them cleaned up, get them back on their feet again, get them some skills and get them out. I've done a lot of work with them over the years, and this is a particularly interesting time of year because it's cold. It's really cold. So if you've lived anywhere in the Northeast, we've had those Arctic, whatever they're called, Arctic blasts or something that have brought the temperatures down into the single digits at night and not much into the low 20s by day. Tough to be out on the street. New York City Rescue helps people that are in those situations, families, men, women. It's actually a bigger mix than you'd think. Kids that are is my kid's age, I've seen when I volunteered there, so we're going to have Craig on the phone in a couple of minutes. We have Craig on the phone yet? Sorry, we do. Yes. Actually, let's go. Craig, how are you?
Well, Mike, I'm doing really well, and that was a great summary of the great work we've been doing for 142 years. And if you could see our place today, it is literally standing room only. We have opened up our doors, and any place we can put a chair, we've got people in here trying to stay warm, because it's truly life-threatening out there today.
Yeah, I mean, it's... You know, those of us that have safe houses, those of us that have places to go, those of us that have heat in our apartments, it's bad enough to be out in the street in between walking from the subway to your apartment. The streets are quiet. I know I was out last night and had a more ambitious agenda that I kind of curtailed after walking into a headwind for 10 minutes. I said, what am I doing? This is one of those nights, just stay home and watch some reruns. What are you doing, kid? And, you know, the economic times are tough. You know, I first worked with you all, just to, by way of background. You're new to, relatively new as the executive director. Back in the day, I had a job at WOR, really iconic, great New York radio station, one of the last of the great independents. And we were coming into one winter, and we wanted to do some outreach, and I sat down with the then GM, Bob Bruno, and I thought, you know, there's this great place called the New York City Rescue. Why don't we do like a one-week fundraiser for them? We'll call it the Super Bowl, spelled S-O-U-P, that would culminate in chefs going down. I think I was there the first year. A lot of big-name chefs have been involved where they donated a recipe for soup or came in and made soup or did whatever the above, and we had a call-in to raise funds for you guys, which was a pretty successful endeavor. WOR has since bought by Clear Channel. They've gone another direction. But so you and I are going to talk a little bit about that today. If you can, we're not so, this isn't such a fundraising radio network that way, but if people are listening to this and like the story, how does one contribute to the New York City Rescue? Where do they go? Is there a website?
Probably the easiest way is nycrescue.org. And when you come to our homepage, you'll see lots of opportunities to click a button that will take you to a giving page. So
nycrescue.org. Easy to remember that. If you're listening out there anywhere in America, it's great. So tell us the story. This is a relatively new audience for me. Tell us a little bit about the history of New York City Rescue, because it's pretty epic. I mean, 145 years of doing what?
Yep. Well, actually, in your intro, you said New York's first mission, but we're actually America's first, and actually started a movement that spread to the East Coast and into the Midwest and all the way to California. There are now over 300 missions like us that can trace their heritage all the way back 1872 here in New York City with this mission. And initially it focused on just getting men overnight shelter, food, trying to clean them up. and as you said in your intro, give them a new start. But over the years, we've expanded to both care for immediate needs and emergency situations, but we also have men that this becomes their home for a year, and they're in recovery dealing with addictions, alcoholic, chemical dependency, all kinds of problems that are they're causing the homelessness, and we try to address those. And we're successful when they graduate, they get a job, they have independent living, and we're just completing an expansion of 3 floors that will double our numbers. And so we'll every night have 250 people living in this building, and hopefully experiencing hope and life change.
And to put a face on this, so I have volunteered a couple of times for Thanksgiving because you do a great Thanksgiving meal where you bus people from shelters all around the city. Yep. It's all day long, from 10 in the morning till 9 o'clock at night. Yep. In between, we would clean the dining room. We would bus the tables. When the new guests sat down, we would bring out the food. We would pour beverages, all that sort of stuff. And to put a face on homelessness in New York, we're not just looking at scruffy guys that probably drank too much.
No.
There are homeless families who were there out of happenstance. There's mothers with children who don't have husbands, who have just been sort of pushed into homelessness because of the cost of living in this town. I saw kids in their early 20s, looked like college kids. I mean, homelessness, the face of homelessness in New York is pretty broadly stretched across the spectrum.
Yeah, it's almost as diverse as the city.
Yeah.
You just summarized it. There's no one reason why someone becomes homeless. It's very easy to stereotype them and just kind of say, well, you made bad choices, you found yourself in the street. So we have a man right now that was elderly, that was struggling to make ends meet, Upper East Side. He got hit by a car, badly injured, came out needing lots of help, medical help, and eventually found himself homeless. And it's hard to think that we don't have a safety net to catch people like that, but it really happens. And so, we're a place of compassion, and I want to say, and the week that you guys, we launched this Super Bowl thing, it was a fabulous idea, because part of what we're also trying to communicate is that, you think of soup kitchen, you think kind of a dirty, dingy, not very good service. We're actually have raised the bar to say we're going to do the very best for the least of our community and really make it a fantastic week. And I want to tell you about what we got lined up for a Super Bowl week. It's going to be amazing.
Talk, please.
Well, you started all this, and we really appreciate it. So we have right now 4 nights filled with, I think Wednesday night we have Chef Dino Gatto of Rao's, who's a chef, one of the best chefs in the city. He's going to come here, and he's going to serve up a special recipe. We have a chef on Tuesday from Tasting Table, Brendan McHale, and on Monday we have Chef Vito Marcello, and Thursday the International Culinary Center is going to come. So these are 4 nights where we're going to go beyond a bowl of soup for the Super Bowl. This is going to be a great meal that we're going to put on for our guests. And then Super Bowl Sunday itself, and this is my second Super Bowl as the director, and we're throwing a huge party here for the homeless. So we're going to have 3 screens, video projection with the game, and a buffet of food, and we're just going to have a great party for the homeless of our city. And actually, it's not just for the homeless. Anyone wants to come down to 90 Lafayette Street, you're welcome to join us.
Yeah, well, that was the other question. When we started this at WOR, we were trying to keep it. WOR, it was a downtown station. For years, it had been uptown, been Times Square. But by the time I came along, it was at 111 Broadway, which is Wall Street was my stop. And we're trying to find something downtown that spoke to us. And I thought, you guys just do such amazing work. And I can also attest, I've been to some of the graduations you've had where you've had people, guys, girls that were, as you just talked about alcohol and addiction, this is stuff in America that just gets swept under the rug. There is no treatment for it. All we do is either lock these people up or watch them sink to the bottom. Insurance doesn't pay for it. If you don't come from a family of means, you're pretty much dead in the water. Anyway, it's hard enough to get out of that web, and it's really touching to see the men and women get up on stage for graduation, talk about what they've been through, about what you guys have done, how you've touched them, turned their lives around, and really given them a second chance that for many of these people, they would have never had that opportunity.
Yeah, that's really true. I mean, I get a front row seat. I think I have the best job in the world because I get to watch people come in off the street literally on, despair, no hope, and 9-12 months later when we have these graduations, their family's there, they're weeping, they're so thankful that their son or their husband or their cousin or their best friend has been returned to them in one piece and they're whole and they have a new life ahead of them. So, we, as I said, we'll care for anybody that shows up. There's no obligation. We'll feed you. We'll give you a bed. We'll give you some clothes, a hot shower. But if you want more than that, it's here for you. We can help you change your life. And Mike, for the first time in our history, when our building is complete this spring, we're going to have an emergency shelter on site here for women. because it's been focused mainly on men for overnight, and we feed and clothe women, but we're going to actually be able to begin to do more for the women in our community who are suffering.
You had a Mother's Day thing, if I'm not mistaken, a couple of years ago that I was involved with, which was where you went to the shelters.
Yeah.
And
still do that.
It was just epic. It was just, you know, women who, by way of not, you know, you almost think a lot of them wasn't just by choice, it was just by happenstance. This is a tough town. It's an expensive town.
Yeah,
it's easy to fall through the cracks. Women are particularly vulnerable. So these were women and their children who were just bussed in from all over the city, from every shelter, and fed. And it was a great thing. Folks, if you're listening to this, we should also mention that the New York Rescue Mission exists solely on the basis of donations. They're not getting government money. There's no big fat cats behind it. It's pretty much donation only. That's how this stuff works. It's done out of the kindness and beneficence of the community. And in this case, I'm reaching out to the greater community around America, the Heritage Radio Network people that are listening. NYCRescue.org is the website. We always say this when I did the live things on WR, $1, $2, $5, $10, and everything you can afford. It's a great story. They do great work. They save lives that otherwise would probably be lost to despair.
Yep. And so I would just add to that to your listeners, you know, that obviously your listeners care about food. And we have three chefs here, one of whom was on the show called Chopped. Was featured there. They're really good. They're talented. They work. We have great recipes and stuff. But we do have to buy the food, most of the food. $300,000 a year at least is the minimum food bill that we have. So if you send a small donation in, you're going to be putting food in front of somebody Super Bowl week. That's going to be special.
Well, you're welcome back on this program anytime. This is an especially cold winter, so it's a topic that's really germane. It was really a pleasure to have started that Super Bowl event, I don't know how many, 6 or 7 years ago. I haven't done that many great things in my life. This is something I'm really proud about. And thank you for the work you do day in and day out, your staff down there. Again, that's nycrescue.org, America's oldest mission. They've been doing nothing but the work that nobody else wants to do, great work, charitable work, since then, nonstop, and they're growing. Thanks so much, Craig Mize, Executive Director. And have a great Super Bowl week. Thanks so much.
Thank you. My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Hey, thank you. Folks, again, that's nycrescue.org. If you have you know, anything in the kindness of your heart, they really appreciate it. This is a donation well spent. Okay. Catch your breath, Mike. You're doing radio now. Slow down. Remember Radio 101? All right. I've got a guest now who, of all the years I've done radio, I've never had him on, and I can't understand why. But I have talked about him often. If his ears were ringing, they would have rung hundreds of times, because I'm a real wine guy as much as a food guy, because to me the two go hand in hand. There is no dinner without wine. How do I describe Roger Daghorn? And I mean this in the kindest of ways. I've always said he's the Yoda of sommeliers. And I say that because if you think of that character, Yoda was sort of this omniscient, beneficent, little guy that just didn't have a bad bone in his body and knew everything. Well, Roger Daghorn, for those who don't know him, he's, you know, about 5 feet five, 5 feet six. You know, it looks like he could be an accountant in a midtown firm somewhere. He doesn't dress flashy, doesn't have tattoos, doesn't have a beard down to his navel today. But you mentioned the name Roger Daghorn to sommeliers who have been around the block once or twice, and they bow. He is the man. Roger, welcome to Food Talk.
Thank you, Michael.
So
good
great
to see you.
No, so great to have you. Now, I should, by way of background, Roger and I worked together, and this will get me into another segue. You and I worked together you were on the floor as a sommelier at the Maurice restaurant.
Right.
All through the early 80s.
Park
and Meridian Hotel.
That's right.
I was there. My wife was my girlfriend at the time. She was the pastry chef. I worked my way up quickly to be the sous chef. The chef was the amazing Christian Delouvrier, who's still practicing.
Oh, yes.
Still cooking up a storm. Folks, if you're living in and around New York and you like French food, there's a lot of little places opening up that I've talked about here before, like Les Philosophes and Calliope, and of course Lafayette and Balthazar. But go to Le Mangeoir. Le Mangeoir is on the Upper East Side. I think it's 2nd Avenue or 3rd Avenue in the 50s.
2nd and 53rd Street.
2nd and 50s. There is not a better French kitchen in the city. L'Absinthe is great, but Christian's the man. I don't know how much longer he's going to be there. He's always talking about retiring at some point. It is phenomenal. And it's funny, because that was I had started at the Four Seasons. I graduated the CIA in 82, got a job at the Four Seasons, and there was something happened at the Maurice where I think your sous chef in Tournal got fired for stealing something one day, and my wife was doing her internship there, and she said, Mike, they're looking for people. So I had to switch my gig at the Four Seasons to get from dinner to lunch so I could work dinner at the Maurice. So I started working two jobs for about 7 months until Christian offered me a sous chef job. So what a great way to come to New York. My first job was the Four Seasons restaurant, which was iconic. My second was with a young Christian Delouvrier at the Maurice. But to the best of your recollection, How many sommeliers were there working on the floor in New York at that time?
Oh, there was, perhaps half a dozen.
Period. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about Lutèce, La Côte Basque.
Oh, not even Lutèce.
None of these restaurants had, I mean, Caravelle, the Four Seasons didn't have one. I know that for a fact. No. Danielle, Le Cirque at that point. I mean, nobody. So this was a job, and it's funny because, I mean, I kind of took it for granted. I'm a kid from Philly, and I'm like, yeah, sommeliers. He helps with the wine. But this was a career that almost didn't exist back then.
It was interesting because, going back 20, 30 years ago, whenever I was called for jury duty, I was always the first person to be called. And nobody understood why. People would gather around me and say, well, you know, I'd be the first one called but never chosen. It was only until the last day of my time there that the lawyer, again, called me, first person to be called, says, now, here's a name, here's a profession that you find only on crossword puzzles.
And how times have changed. But we'll get to that in a minute. How did you – so your father was a chef. I remember that because at one point he needed to take a vacation and you asked me if I'd fill in for him. At that point, he was towards the end of his career and he was doing corporate chefing, I think, for a bank somewhere in Midtown, mm-hmm. one of those, you know, Marriott or something. And I remember meeting him. Charming guy. Wonderful man. How did you get into the sommelier business?
Well, you know, it's interesting. My family had a restaurant, a French restaurant, which in those days was considered a very good restaurant. Today, in today's terms, it was a typical French bistro. It goes back, it was around for a good 17, 18 years. And they focused on wine. They were probably the first restaurant in New York to do winemaker dinners, and they would do it on a regular basis. Every Thursday evening would be a wine dinner, and they would every month it would focus on a different region of France, and one month, of course, would be California, because, of course, we had to bow our hats to the great California wines, which, of course, today are probably key to the wine industry in America. And French restaurants and French wines are still popular, but not nearly as much as they used to be. But in any case, that's where I had my first exposure. My father was a chef, but he also was a sommelier. He took a wine course, a sommelier course, way back when. And, of course, he was first in his class. And his partner, my cousin, a couple years later, took the same course. And he was first in his class. Mm-hmm. So when I graduated from college and had a degree in geology that became earth and environmental sciences, and all that was nice, but difficult to find work, I always found work in the restaurant business. Mm-hmm. So I worked at my father's restaurant, and I said, well, you know, if you're going to focus on wine and be first in your class, I'm going to take the same class. And of course, I had to be first, and I was, and I had a higher score, and so that became my competitive nature, and it just snowballed from there. I wasn't necessarily so interested in wine initially, but I realized it's interesting. It's an interesting subject, and there's so much to learn, and you never stop learning, and that's what wine is about.
Let's talk. I mean. So I go back, I'm guessing we're close to the same age. I'm probably a bit older than you. I who knows? But
I doubt that.
When I started in the business, you know, most of the great restaurants, there was some Italian food, but it was a little more casual. So the great restaurants in New York in the 70s and 80s, throughout the 80s, were French. It was the above four, you know, Lutèce, La Côte Basque, La Caravelle, La Vendue, Le Cygne, the Leilas uptown. And so my palate was kind of formed around two regions, which is Bordeaux and Burgundy. That's kind of what was, those were the regions that ruled the roost back then. Let's talk about how far viticulture has come in the last 15 or 20 years outside of Bordeaux and Burgundy. Other regions of France, like Languedoc, Roussillon, throughout Italy, California, Spain, and on and on and on. It's just remarkable to walk into wine shops these days and see the just the incredible bottles from $15 up that are just really wonderful drinkable wines.
Yeah. Well, wine has become international. And, of course, the wines of France, the wines of Italy, were the showcase. France had the reputation for quality. Italian wines at that time had the reputation of quantity, but changed that around dramatically. And other parts of the world started to come through with great wines, or have just becoming discovered. Wines of Spain, wines of, Germany had been around a long time. But again, the wine world evolves so quickly. There are ups and there are downs, and one little scandal can create a major disaster for a wine region, and a movie can do major damage to grape varieties.
Yes, we like poor Merlot.
Yes. And by the way, Chateau Petrus is Merlot.
Thank you.
And I guess that should be included in that movie.
Yeah, no, it's right. I mean, when we think of Bordeaux varietals and right bank Bordeaux varietals, like people, hold on, wait a second, time out. do these names mean anything to you? That's right, Petrus coming out at the top. Talk a bit about the job of a sommelier, because I think that I get to think we're becoming more accustomed to it, because it's so. I mean, there's so many restaurants now that. I mean, you're not really serious if you don't have somebody on the floor that acts as a somm or is a somm. But I think for people that aren't familiar with it, there's a bit of pretense and there's a bit of fear. And I think everyone has like a nightmare somm story. And I'll tell you mine because it's kind of humorous. When I was hosting the show at WOR, I lived in the West Village for most of those years. And I walked around all the time when I was off air, just how I am. And I would walk past the Waverly Inn all the time. John DeLuzzi was the chef. He knew me from TV and radio. And he kept saying, you got to come in. I'm like, dude, Waverly Inn is, you know, it's not my hang. It's Graydon Carter. It's the A-list of celebrities. But to be nice, I came in one night with a friend. She does not drink much, usually a glass of champagne and that's it. So good, you know, cheap date, wonderful. And I said, you know, I know I'm not going to get comped. So I'll order a couple of things. You send something out. And he says, I'm going to send out the lamb. He was famous for it. So the sommelier came over to the table, and I had a Negroni, like I always do before dinner. And he said, what do you drink? I said, you know, real, she doesn't drink at all. Glass of champagne will be fine. I'll have a glass of Bordeaux. I kind of like Bordeaux and lamb, just I don't know why, old school. Mm-hmm. And he holds up the wine list, and he says, well, why don't you try this? And I don't have my glasses on. It's 3 feet away. And I said, what is it? So it's a half bottle. I said, well, all right, so it's a couple of glasses. That's fine. Yeah. We get the bill. At the end of the meal, and it was $420. it was a split of Petrus, and I just remember thinking, what did you do? I asked you for a glass of wine, which gives you some indication of what I want to spend, which is kind of like one of the little things you're looking for. You know, you upsell me to a half a bottle of something that's ridiculous, and I just remember thinking, this is, you know, I'll never come back here again, and if I ever see you on the street again, I'm going to kick you in the shins. but the truth is, talk about what a somm does, because I remember you at Chanterelle, you were my somm, obviously on the Mirage through the floor. What's your interaction with the customer? How do you work that as a Sherpa? How do you work that? What do you feel that your, quote, job or mission is?
Well, as a sommelier, in every place I've worked, I didn't work on commission. And I didn't like the idea. I worked for the house, and yes, but I also worked for the consumer. And working for the consumer helps the house. So I'm there to suggest a wine that will work with the food. And if I recommend a good, reasonably priced wine for the food, hey, you may have a second glass. It's better than selling a high-priced wine that you have to remember what makes the price is its rarity oftentimes more than its quality. And so you don't know that. The consumer doesn't always understand that. There's plenty of good wines out there that are not expensive, and the reason why they're not expensive is because they're not the profits don't go into marketing, they go into putting it back into the vineyards and the winemaking. And these are the really interesting wines. And oftentimes people don't know about them because, okay, they're not marketed. Okay, they're not marketed. And they're better, generally better. And sometimes the smaller producers, you know, they're struggling, but they have passion in what they do, and that's what the wine world is about. It's about passion.
Yeah, you visit these vineyards, you visit the vignoble, and a lot of these times, these men and women, you visit them at the end of the summer towards crushing, they've got dirt under their fingernails and calluses
in their hands.
Calluses, I mean, literally, I've seen it so many times, and dirt encrusted under their fingernails, and their lips are purple. This is what they live for. This is not, no one's getting rich off of this. Their mission is to try and make good wine every single year, which is almost like alchemy to me, because you think about all of the things that could go wrong. From the spring to the from the fruit set to the bud to the rain to no rain to too much rain to all the way through harvest, the whole thing's a complete disaster waiting to happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
I honestly like it.
As I say, if you want to make a small fortune in the wine industry, start off with a big fortune.
That's true. On that subject of smaller regions, so we're lucky as consumer these days. America is pretty much the number one target market for most viticulture, because we are one of the few places where we're increasing our per capita consumption. I see a generational shift. Of course, part of that generational shift is because I'm on the old end of the equation. Damn, that happened. But, you know, I'm at the eat all the time, and I see these kids in their late 20s, barely 30, who are so savvy, who look at these wine lists, two new varietals that I learned about 2 or 3 years ago, if then. And wine stores that are the same sort of thing. I've got a wine store near me called September Wines, a little corner store, Lower East Side. And I go in, I tell them what I'm making for dinner, what the flavors are, how it's going to be prepared, my price range. They've gotten to know what I like. And invariably, they find me some great bottle of wine for $18 to $24, mostly Old World. But talk a little bit about what you see in terms of generational, like kids today drinking wine, because you're on the floor. You're working now. We should talk about this, by the way. You were Chanterelle for many, many years.
Yep.
Great restaurant, Karen David Waltock.
16 years.
New York legacy. So sad to have seen that go down. Then you were with Michael LaMonaco at Porterhouse for a while.
3.5 years. A wonderful experience.
Michael's a great, great guy.
Sure is.
World-class guy. Great guy all around. New York story. Brooklyn boy. Great kid. Great chef. And I love that. Love that restaurant. And you are where today?
I'm with a restaurant group. It's called 1-5 Hospitality, which is based out of Tocqueville, but it also now includes 15 East, their Japanese restaurant, the original location of Tocqueville, and it also includes the Fourth and Single, S-I-N-G-L, for single vineyard wines in the Cuvenay and single malt scotches in a bar lounge in the new Union Square Hyatt Hotel.
Just steps off 14th Street. I have not been to that. I can tell you that Tocqueville is one of the jewels in the city. Marco is the chef. Marco Riera is wonderful, wonderful chef. His wife's usually on the floor.
Yep.
It's just a jewel of a restaurant. And 15 East is on everybody's short list of really one of the top 10 Japanese sushi sashimi restaurants in the city.
Mm-hmm.
We're gonna change subjects just for 1 minute, because if we're going to talk about sushi sashimi, I didn't let you answer the last question I asked. Someday I'll figure out how to do interviews. But I remember the late 90s, Chanterelle, tasting menu. I always do this with tasting menus. Chef can send out whatever they want. I have no allergies. There's nothing I don't like. And whoever is the somm on the floor can pair wines, because who would know better what's going to work with the chef's food? Although I don't need to look at the wine list. I don't know what's coming next. I'm in your hands. So just give me a bill when I'm done. And at some point, you paired sake with something. Might have been chicken, might have been pork. I don't even remember. And I just remember thinking, really? You were one of the pioneers of Western guys, of sommeliers, to start pouring sake as part of a wine program in a non-Japanese restaurant.
Yeah.
How'd that happen?
Well, I had always been curious about sake, but I was always disappointed in the sake, the quality of the sake that I was tasting in the 70s, 80s, 90s. But it was, early in the mid-90s, 1990s, I had gone to a private tasting for what they call jizakis, or small local sake producers. And most of the sakis that were available were large producers, just like having California jug wine.
Right.
Well, this was the Japanese version for sake. And in this case, there were about 30 plus different sakis, and they were all small producers, handcrafted sakis. And all generally in the Junmai Ginjo, Junmai Daiginjo quality level, where the rice is milled down to below 60 and 50%. Its original size, getting closer to the kernel where the starch is and where the flavor is. And these sakes generally had less of a ricey aroma to them and a much more floral and fruity aroma to them. And I thought at that point, when I tasted through these, I could see an affinity to certain grape varieties. And I said, hey, you know, I can pair these with some dishes that David Waltuck was creating. And at that time, he had two menus that changed every month. It would be a three-course tasting menu and the six-course tasting menu. And with the six-course tasting menu, of course, I would pair wines with each course for those who wanted that. And I figured, well, invariably, one course can be paired with sake. And I used to do a lot of experimenting with that. And it became natural. After a while, I knew what worked. And this was Western cuisine, but of course David's cuisine was kind of eclectic too, so it had a lot of Asian touches to it, a lot of Mediterranean touches. He dealt with everything and did it well. And it was a challenge. And it was a challenge to find wines that were of the quality to stand up to those dishes. And it didn't just work with wine, it also worked with sake.
Yeah. That was the first time I'd seen it, and it's funny because I'm seeing it now on menus, and I always go back to thinking, man, Daghorn was on that 16, 17 years ago. Talk to us, just without getting too geeked out, but I don't think most people understand how sake is made, and it's relatively straightforward. So we're starting with a rice that's specifically grown to become sake. This isn't rice that's going to become something else. You're not going and bang a bag of rice that you're going to mix.
Well, you can make sake with normal rice.
Okay.
The high-end sakis are made by what they call sake rice.
Right.
And what this is, these are long-grain rice where the starch is concentrated in the center. And normal rice is milled down to about 92% its original size so that you can cook with it, and the starch is throughout the grain. But sake rice, it's concentrated in the center.
So it's milled finer and finer and finer.
The more it's milled, the more of the lipids and the oils and proteins are removed, and it's more starch. And that's where the core of making quality sake comes from. And as you get, the closer you get, it gets harder and takes longer and it's a more expensive process to make. Therefore, sake can be expensive. But the process is simple. Once it's milled and the rest goes for feeding cattle or making rice crackers, which is interesting, but they take the rice and they steam it. They take 10% and they steam it and they put it into a special room and they inoculate it with an enzyme and it slowly converts from starch to sugar. It becomes translucent from white stage to a translucent stage. Then they take another 10% and they add a special yeast concentrate. And then that's mixed with this koji rice, which is the sacrificed rice. And then you get a process called multiple parallel fermentation where the starch becomes sugar, and the sugar becomes alcohol side by side. And the process takes about a month. And it's washed very, very carefully by the Toji master. And it can be pasteurized or it could be unpasteurized. It could be namasake, which is draft sake, basically. And just like the BATF says that wine is a fermented grape juice. They call sake a rice wine, but actually, sake is more like beer because it's a starch that's converting to rice and to sugar, and sugar converting to alcohol.
Right, versus wine, where it's the sugar's naturally present in the fruit.
Exactly.
Some wines, the yeast is naturally present on the outside if they haven't been spraying, and it's just, you crush grapes, you're going to end up with wine naturally before it turns to vinegar at some point.
Exactly. So there are many different styles of sake, and it all depends on the water. It depends on the rice. It depends on the yeast. Right. It depends on so many factors, right. The land. And so the diversity is great. Unfortunately, the sake industry in Japan has dwindled dramatically in the last 100 years from over 10,000 different breweries to now less than 1,200 breweries. But what's coming out of it is that there's less sake, but much higher quality.
You're seeing it here in the States. There's a wonderful, relatively new restaurant down by me on Ludlow or Orchard called Sake Mai that's great, that has a great chef in it and mm-hmm. a really nice sake list, and I love it. And some of the good ramen places will have sake that's great. Anyway, thanks for you for really being one of the pioneers and sort of bringing that into the Western kitchen.
My pleasure, sir.
And dining room. Now, so let's talk my other question, which I didn't even let you answer. And you must notice this because you're on the floor. Is it just my imagination because we're getting older, but aren't these younger, and I'm going to call them kids, sorry, if you're under 32 in my book, you're a kid, but these kids who are sort of late 20s and 30s who use must-see on the floor all the time, yeah. It's like a new generation that are just totally wine geeks, like wine
yeah.
knowledgeable.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I see them all the time, and many of them are going through the Master Sommelier program, and it's become a cult. In fact, there's a new movie out, I haven't even seen it yet, yeah. called Somm. It's all about how to become a master sommelier, and it's a hard process.
It's ridiculous.
I went through it, and thank God I don't have to do it again.
I'm not sure, because a lot of it's really esoteric. It's brutal.
Oh, it is. But the thing is, that's the fun of it all, and it's challenging, and everybody's of like mind, and so they challenge each other. They throw questions back at each other, and the constantly tasting, it's a fascinating world.
Yeah, it's funny.
It's passionate.
I was talking to Paul Greco a while back, and we were talking about this thing about the Somms. Really, there weren't Somms on the floor in New York for most of the 90s. It's a new thing. And back then, you would go to a bar at a good restaurant, and if you wanted wine by the glass, they probably had two choices for you, maybe three. And it would be mm-hmm. an oaky Chardonnay or an insipid Merlot from California. And that would be about it. And that's what people ask for. I'll have a Chardonnay or have a Merlot. That was your choice. I mean, now people are walking up to a bar at a restaurant and being offered an amazing palette of all sorts of wines.
Well, I was just looking at the bar selection here at Roberta's, and I was just fascinated. In fact, in front of me, I ordered a glass of Manzanilla. It's like the perfect starter wine before a meal, and it's gonna lower my blood sugar and make me hungry, and it's a perfect. And it's interesting because the choice now is eclectic. There's diversity, and they're all food wines, and people are looking for interesting. They don't want the ordinary anymore. And there's so many great new wines out there from all over, not just from France or Italy. You find great Greek wines, Portuguese wines, wines from Chile and Argentina. South Africa is making some outstanding wines. You don't have to go very far. Even Long Island is coming up with some interesting wines too. Finger Lakes, Ontario, Okanagan Valley in British Columbia. Places that most people have no clue exist.
I remember I had a friend of mine that was a New York couple, both doctors, both brilliant. They ended up at University of Virginia, both practicing and teaching. And I would go visit them in Charlottesville. And I remember coming across these reds. I forget what the varietals were. Forgive me. I should know that, but whatever. These wonderful world-class wines coming from Virginia.
Yep.
I was like, what is this? I mm-hmm. had no idea there was serious viticulture taking place.
Well, there's wine being made in 50 states. Yeah. In Alaska, the grapes are brought in to be made into wine, but still, it's 50 states.
Yeah. So a wine that sort of came up on the radar that's a funny wine-producing region, the Jura. I mean, that's one of these, like, screwball 1% of French production, I think, is from Jura. A funny style of wine. You get those vergeant, those almost oxidized kind of wine. Talk a bit about the wines from that region, because I find them so interesting as food pairing.
Well, they make white wine and red wine.
Right.
And the grape varieties are indigenous, which is unique. The wine that you're talking about, the Vingon, et cetera, are made from a grape variety called Sauvignon, which is a distant cousin to Chardonnay. But what it is, it's made a little bit like sherry. In effect, they're fermented in barrels, about two-thirds full, and as they're going through the process, sometimes they form a little yeast layer on top, which maintains this little freshness in the wines and below the yeast, the floor, if you want to call it. And so it takes on that little nutty aroma. And if it loses the floor, it takes on more almondy aromas, just like an Amontillado, if you like. But this is the character of the wine. It's dry. It's different. I actually, it's not just dry. It's bone dry.
Bone dry. Austere. Bone dry.
Yes,
I remember
very
the
much so.
Very first time I had it, I thought it was a bad bottle. I thought it was Madeira. I thought this is the color was wrong. The nose was wrong. I'm like, there's something wrong with this. And whoever it was really kind. They're like, sir, actually, this is the style of the production.
Yes,
it's slightly oxidized. It will seem to dare eyes. Well, it's going to work very well with the blue cheese that you have next
definitely.
To you.
Well, I actually have a Sauvignon on my list from the Jura at Tocqueville, and I always preface it to the customer, this is a unique wine. It isn't to everybody's taste, but it is the way it should be. And then I have them taste it first, and some people say, oh, it's exactly what I'm looking for. And then you have the others say, no, I really don't like this. Well, that's fine.
Right.
And it's good if we can do it by the glass. That's ideal. If it's not by the glass, then it becomes a financial nightmare. But
right, what do you do with this bottle? That's right.
But wines like that, they do not go to waste. They can be sold by the glass to customers who are just looking for just that type of wine.
And so it's southeast of Burgundy. It's tiny, tiny, tiny. Arbois. Talk about this, because this is another one I've had recently that I just kind of fell in love with. It's a strange, unusual, had this great acidity, this great minerality to it, paired whatever I was having that night paired really well. Talk about this. This is another, I think the one I had was, I actually wrote the label down. It was a Jenny and Francois Bio Organic, which was another discussion we'll have. But this is another like kind of funky little area.
Yeah. Well, it's the wine region on the foothills of the Jura. And it goes well with the local cheeses. They're white and they're red, and they have a cult following, and yet not many people know about them. But you know, they're there, and they're worth looking into.
Oh, I found it with this. I remember getting this wine, and then I don't usually do this, but I liked it so much, I took a picture of the label with my cell phone and went home and Googled it. And, of course, Jenny and Francois, you know, is an importer that prides themselves of just everything they do is bio-organic. Husband and wife, 7 acres, 2 years on the lees. I mean, it was sort of no wonder, like, duh, where can I find this bottle of wine? You know, a region that I kind of fell in love with in the mid-2000s, in 2005, I was there filming and working kind of with them to promote the wine. And what a change they've made is the Beaujolais Cruze. Ah. I mean, these are wines that, I mean, we all think of Beaujolais, in a way, thank God for Georges de Boeuf, because he was a really ambassador for the region when no one was drinking Beaujolais. Of course, Beaujolais Nouveau is a whole other story. I would rather not talk about that, but it raises money quickly for the vigneron. But the Beaujolais Cruze, which are the specific, is it 10 or 11?
10.
10. 10 crews, and to have that, you have to just come from the region, and you're seeing...
It's the northern third of the Beaujolais region, which is a hillier region. It's granitic soil, whereas the southern part of Beaujolais is pretty much sandy soil. Now, the hilly soil, the southern exposure gets much more sun, and because of that, they get naturally a little higher alcohol. And yes, still by the process of carbonic maceration is found in the 10 crews, but less. More of the wines that are made traditional method are found in the 10 crew, especially the three major ones such as Moulin Avant, Morgon, and Julianas. And so they have potential to age a little bit longer, 8 to 12 years, and even more. In certain hands, the wines Gamay grape is generally considered such a one-dimensional grape variety, but it can take on character with age. And again, made by the traditional method as opposed to carbonic maceration, which generally generates a lively, fresh,
energetic,
strawberry,
right.
bubblegum aroma,
right.
bananas. But it doesn't necessarily have to be just that. It can be more than that. And it goes great with the local cuisine, especially from around Lyon and the Bouchon, those bistros there. They're ideal for Beaujolais.
Yeah. I want to get out of France, but one more quick question. Loire Valley. I've kind of fallen in love with the Loire Valley.
Uh-huh.
And again, and with France, you sort of need this decoder ring. You know, you're drinking... because they don't, I mean, in America, we list varietals on the label. In France,
yes,
they don't. So if you're in Bordeaux, you're probably drinking Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, Merlot, Petit Verdot in some blend. If you're in Burgundy, it's all Pinot Noir. If you're in Beaujolais, it's all Gamay. But then you get a Cab Franc, and you know, it can be anything. It's not called Cab Franc out of Loire Valley. Talk about Loire Valley.
Yeah.
Because it's really it's some wonderful grape varietals.
Oh, yes. And you have four distinct regions. Upper Loire Valley, you have the Central Valley, which is part of the Paris Basin, so it's chalky soil or tufo, which they call there. And then there you find mostly Sauvignon Blanc. And therefore you have Sancerre, you have Ruy and Puy-Fumé. There's a little bit of red wine and rosé made from Pinot Noir. And then as you go further down river, you come to the region of the Touraine, around the city of Tours. And here it's still part of the Paris Basin. And here you find more Chenin Blanc in appellations such as Vouvray and Mont-Louis. And a little bit now you're finding red wine from Cabernet Franc, locally known as Cabernet Boucher, and in appellations such as Chinon and Bourgogne and Saint-Nicolas de Bourgogne. And then across the Paris Basin line, you get into the Anjou-Saumur region, and then you get some really eclectic wines, again, oftentimes from Chenin Blanc, in such appellations as Savonnières and Coteau de Lyon. They can be dry, off dry, sweet,
right,
sparkling,
right,
exceptional wines, but tiny, tiny productions. And again, more Cabernet Franc, such as in Anjou-Saumur or Saumur Champigny, and rosé becomes king there. And then lastly, at the mouth of the Loire, you have the region of Muscadet.
Yeah. It's
which
great.
Is very, very interesting, too. And, of course, there's Gros Lot for red wine, but, you know, it's not serious, very serious wines, but who cares if you're having a nice hot dog? You know, it's perfect.
And Muscadet is the classic oyster pairing.
You know, Muscadet, definitely.
Classic.
Yeah.
I don't drink enough, and you're going to help me school. We're going to get you back on this program at some point in the not-too-distant future, but I don't drink a lot of New World wines, and I don't drink a lot of American wines. And part of it is, I don't know if my palate's just been informed by Italian, French, Spanish, Greek, German. We didn't even talk about Riesling today, which we could devote an entire show on.
Sure.
But I think it's hard for me to find American wines that I like at my price point. My price point's like $18 to $25. Help me there. Help me explain why that is. And then maybe give me a few suggestions of things I should try.
Well, I think that in California, they've grown into this cult status world of high-end Cabernet Sauvignon in Napa Valley. And granted, they are very good, but extremely expensive, very, very low yields, higher alcohol, fruit bombs, if you want. There are some really good producers, and there are some, and many that are just average, but you have to look at California as the New World, so the wines are cleaner in a way. They're fruitier, fruit forward. They can be jammy, and because of that movie, I think I forget the name of it, but Pinot Noir has become king there. But if you take a look at a lot of the Pinot Noir from California, they are jammy, they are high in alcohol, they're ruby color. My goodness, I remember red Burgundies, the true Pinot Noir. They're garnet color. They're lighter. Right?
Really and, light. You can see that personality when you pour into a glass.
And they're quite aromatic, but they're not alcoholic. And they don't necessarily taste the fruit. They taste more aromas of truffles.
Yeah, the soil is leaves. Right. The French have that word sous-bois, I think, with that wet kind of...
Wet leaves.
Wet leaves, right, that you get. That's what I'm getting all the time. Mm-hmm. Truffles, wet leaves, mushrooms.
And especially the Côte Nuit. Yes, the Côte d'Ivoire, you get some cherries and such. But you have it's they're more austere, right. Whereas
restrained.
In California, restrained, and whereas in the New World, it's much more in your face, much more forward. But you know, you take other parts of the New World. You take, for instance, Oregon. You take a look at the South Island of New Zealand, Central Otago, Marlborough, and even on North Island, Martinborough. Some of the Pinot Noir that are coming out of there are exceptional. And even Pinot Noir from Chile and Argentina and Patagonia, they are remarkable.
Okay.
So great wines can come from anywhere these days.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. All right. Well, a question that I've asked everyone that's always puzzled me, and you're the guy that's going to be probably the definitive answer on this because I've heard a lot of different stories. So I'm at a restaurant. I love Riesling. You know, if anyone knows Paul Greco, if you've ever eaten at Hearth, you're sort of you don't have a lot of choice. The summer, it's been the summer of Riesling since Woodstock, I think, in his mind. But they're great wines, and they're wonderful value. They're misunderstood. I think a lot of people that are new to wine or maybe of a certain age that are older think of Riesling, of German wines, of being sweet, of having a lot of residual sugar.
Yeah.
There's a lot of Rieslings that are purposefully about as dry as they can get them.
Oh, yeah.
But where does petrol come from on the nose? So certain Rieslings I'm poured at a restaurant, and it's unmistakable. I swirl the glass. I'm not getting floral. I'm getting the same note that is referred to as petrol.
Yes.
Because it sort of smells a little like wet stone. I mean, not like gasoline petrol, but you and I know what we're talking about.
Where it's not New Jersey.
It's not. That's right. Where does that come from?
It comes from, I think, that pretty much the soil, also the aging. The more it ages, it develops, especially in Alsace. You do get it also in the Baden region. But different Riesling worlds have different styles of Riesling. You get that apple freshness and leaner, lighter, crisper style of Riesling in Germany, especially in the Mosel. You get a little bit earthier in the Rheingau. You get a very steely style of dry Riesling from Austria, especially from the Vacau region. But Alsace is more known for Rieslings because it's on the leeward side of the Vosges Mountains. More sun, more exposure to the sun, more alcohol, and still good acidity, so you have good ageability. And with age, you get the petrol aroma. But then you get these great Australian Rieslings now that are dry and very age-worthy. That you know, people think Australia, Shiraz. If you want to think of Australia in white wines, okay, Chardonnay maybe, or perhaps Sauvignon or Semillon, as they call it. But their Rieslings are really exceptional. And you know, people don't know them.
I don't know them. I'm making notes. Any producers you can think of? All right, I don't.
Grosset for one.
Okay, I know that. Yeah. I know that name.
And there are quite a few others.
All right, I'll ask my local wine merchant that I trust. We're going to wrap it up in a couple of minutes, but how do you weigh in on it? And I don't mean plus or minus. I've never done on TV or radio or anything I've ever done. I don't bash stuff. I'll let other people do that. I'm just curious, and I'm always learning. And the cool thing is in our business is there's some new varietal I haven't had. There's a new winemaker that's doing something I haven't had. And there's been a real pronounced expansion in terms of promotion of organic and bio wines, two separate things, to the point now where you can go into a wine store that has a reasonable size, and they'll probably have a shelf or a section devoted to bio organic. Well, what's your thought? What's your sense of them?
Because
they're very unique animals.
Yeah,
and some of these bottles are really funky. The term barnyard's coming to mind. They will change from glass to glass during the drinking of a bottle. There's lots of elements that are surprising in there that you may think of almost as being off or being false. But they have kind of a vibrancy to them that's interesting in the right hands. Talk to me about your take.
I believe in biodynamics. I talk to many great winemakers who are leaning towards that direction if they're not already there. Sometimes when you listen to them, it's hard to understand. You take a person such as Barbara Shin out in Long Island. She makes it much more understandable. Basically, it's taking going back to old world winemaking practices, even though it's a process that a viticultural philosophy that was started by Rudolf Steiner in the 1920s, who didn't, I don't even think, drank wine. But what it is that they're taking old world techniques, such as using horses instead of tractors in the vineyards, so that the soil doesn't so get so compacted that it disrupts the biological activity underground, under the grass, so that it helps the roots be healthier. The grapes are harvested by the
cycles of the moon.
Yes, the phases of the moon and the alignment of the stars. But a lot of that has to do with gravity. The water table rises and lowers based on their location. But that's not really new. That's common. You talk to anybody who has any knowledge of geology can tell you that. So, but of course, there are some odd things such as adding cow manure in a cow's horn and putting them
sounds in more superstition.
There has to be something they have to, I guess, sell. But to my mind, though, I find that in the right hands, the wines, the roots are actually healthier. In other words, what would happen is that a great winemaker could still make great wines in off vintages. It's attention to detail.
And because so much of winemaking is, it's growing healthy grapes. It's pre-crush. Yeah. It's almost done. By the time you're at the crush, it's done. It's decided. Yeah. It's like a chef would say 75%, 80% of what I do is buying good ingredients. I can't turn junk into your good meal. I can get great stuff and tweak it. And that's the same thing with winemaking. They're given that season to get the best fruit they can, the healthiest fruit they can, the limit the yield to the point where they want it.
It's having a healthy respect for your product.
I had the pleasure of working with, to promote for a while, 3 or 4 years and travel there, the Languedoc-Roussillon region, which has become, you know, what used to be the great wasteland. It was post-Algeria. That's where France made all the shit. Right. And table wine that was just junk. They're planted in the wrong place.
Times have changed.
Wow. I mean, that's a region. So you're going from almost the Spanish border up to Montpellier, from the water up to the Pyrenees. And it's a really big place. But because of the way it's blessed with nature, there's a lot of organic and bio work being done down there.
And from white wines to red wines to fortified wines to still wines, just a lot of great wine all around.
Roger Dagorn, folks, that's D-A-G-O-R. And Roger, what are your, just because I don't do this sort of stuff, so what are the things behind your name? You're a master sommelier.
I'm a master sommelier. I am a sake samurai, which is kind of unique. I was recently honored by Krug Champagne for Lifetime Achievement Award.
Oh.
So that's kind of nice.
One hell of a house.
Yeah.
You'll find him on the floor where again?
At Tocqueville.
Okay.
Restaurant.
Great restaurant. 15th Street, just off 6th Avenue.
Right. And 5th Avenue.
Avenue, sorry.
But I'm doing the wine programs for all the restaurants in the group, and I also teach 2 days a week at New York City College of Technology.
You do?
New
York City College. Good. Say that one more time for
New York City College of Technology. Part of City University.
And what's the name of the course?
The wine course, introductory and advanced.
All right. So once again, Roger Dagorn, pleasure to have you on the radio. I mention his name, and I'm telling you, Sam's everywhere bow. It really is the Yoda of the business. I've had the pleasure of working with him on the floor of restaurants way back in the day when we were young men. Seems like a lifetime
ago. We're still young.
Thank you. Well, in our minds, anyway. Google his name, and if you're in and around New York, take his courses. He's one of the great wine educators. He's forgot more about wine than most of the supposed experts, I think, actually know. And a humbler man you'll never meet. Pleasure. Folks, you've been listening to Heritage Radio Network. I'm Mike Colomeco. The name of this show is Food Talk. Sometimes it's Wine Talk. I know that we get a lot of Facebook listeners who are listening to this show that are wine people from around the world. Thanks for listening. I don't always talk just about wine, but you can't have food and wine without it in my world. We'll be back next week. We've got a great show coming up. I should know who's on it, but I'm blanking out right now. I don't know. You listen for next week. You'll see. We'll post it on the website. Another great show coming up next week. We'll see you next week. Be well. Eat well often. Mike Colomeco signing off.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website,
or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.